This is that other sports shit. Let's go. Ladies and gentlemen, our hiatus is over. We're back. Yes, we're back. You can all sit back and relax now. Open your ears, close your eyes, go into your dark room like Aaron Rodgers is about to, and just sit back and listen to the soothing voices of myself. Hi, I'm Jesse Thomas. You can follow me at JTT81 on Twitter. And my man Jason Valdez is on the other side. You can
Shout out to anyone who listens to this show on a plane, because I listened to our previous show and this show previous to that, I guess, on a plane. So if you actually download our show, shout out to you.
Folks, we have today what should be a very interesting and educational, yet it should be short. It should be
informative.
We're gonna cover UFC 284, which Jay and I are about to get into, and we both have our consensus take on that. We have stuff like we're gonna talk about the Kyrie trade. We're gonna talk about. I actually want to throw in LeBron James as well. I just found it out today that LeBron James is 36 points away from passing Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
I can't believe you're all-time
points leader in NBA history.
I can't believe you're just finding this out.
I'm just figuring this out. I'm not a basketball guy. I don't follow basketball.
Quickly, Jess, he's playing OKC tonight. Let me throw an over-under at you tonight. Does he score 36, 35 and a half over-under tonight versus OKC?
Under.
Yeah, that's a lot. 36 is a lot.
It's a lot.
But then you know LeBron, he might fuck around and go for like 25 in the first half, and then you're like, oh, fuck. All right, I'm sorry, but I didn't mean to interrupt you. More importantly, Jess, there's football talk. We have one football game left to talk.
Just one. Super Bowl. It's happening, folks. I believe we're in the desert. Are we in Arizona?
That's Arizona, baby.
Shout out to my friend Mike. I can't remember his Twitter. He doesn't get on it very often, but my friend Mike is a huge Cardinals fan. So shout out to him for enduring yet another season of drama in the desert, but now we have the greatest game ever played happening in the desert, and that is the Super Bowl. I firmly believe it is the mecca of all championships.
I mean, it might be. The only thing that I don't like about the Super Bowl, and it's kind of what's cool about it at the same time, but I don't love it, is one game only. And we always do if these teams played four times, five times, or they play the best out of three. I just hate the idea of someone like Eli Manning probably has two championships, because realistically, he probably wouldn't have beat those Patriots two out of three times. But to me,
that's the best part about the Super Bowl.
You're right.
You have Major League Baseball, right? You have the Major League Baseball Championship. It's seven games. You have the NBA Championship, seven games. You have all these You have all these multiple games, multiple chances to get past that first bad game. You know, a lot of teams have like a bad first game. They can rebound and win three, four straight and end it and prove to the world that they're the best team. In football, you have one shot and one shot only. And that's the intriguing part of the Super Bowl to me, is that you only get the one chance. You get the shot to be the underdog, the Nick Foles and the Philadelphia Eagles and the Philly special. That stuff won't happen in a game two, but it will happen in a one and one only game in which you beat the team that shouldn't have been beaten in the Super Bowl. And the same thing, you just brought up Eli Manning. Let's face it. Manny's Giants, both those teams should not have beaten the Patriots, especially the one season when the Patriots were undefeated. They were looking at the only undefeated season. At that point in time, it would have been 18-0. And they would have surpassed the Miami Dolphins. And they get that one shot to prove themselves, and they blew it. The New York Giants and Eli Manning pick up a ship off of Tom Brady's shoulders.
I was thinking about this.
One and done.
I was thinking about this, Jess, and now that you brought up, you weren't even thinking about you had no clue about the LeBron stuff and him breaking the all-time scoring record possibly tonight, probably in the next two to three games. I was thinking a few days ago, because, again, we did take a week off here, when Tom Brady retired, I wanted to sit down with you and go, and maybe we do this next week. Let's look at all of his Super Bowls and pick, you just kind of pick at them. Because I think about that Rams Super Bowl. I don't know if he should have won that one. That one, that's one of those one games that you wonder if they run it back if he wins that X amount of times. You think about that one against the Falcons. That one that got away from Atlanta. Like, there's some real weird ones in there, along with the ones that he probably shouldn't have gave up, like that, at least one of those Giants ones. So, and, you know, and also the game against the Seahawks, the 2 yard line interception. Yeah. Like, there's so many weird little equations that go into Tom Brady's greatness, as opposed to, we don't do that with Joe Montana. We just go, he just never lost in the Super Bowl. Then that equates to the GOAT. We don't do that with LeBron. Interestingly enough, we don't go, well, he lost, so, you know, does equates to not the GOAT. And we don't do that with Montana. It's kind of weird. But anyway, Jess, hey, we got fights to talk. I wanted to start here with you. We're kind of hopping around, but that's what we do on that other sports show. Were you able to catch the Fedor fight?
Yeah, I'll be honest, because Jay, you and I both, we go back in MMA lore. We were around for those Fedor days when he was the undisputed, like, best, not just the best heavyweight, but many people considered him the best fighter on the planet of any weight class, any size, any strength, any type of jiu-jitsu, judo, you know, stand up. He was the best. We were around for those days. We were around for the days when he got dropped head and neck, and somehow rebounded to win by submission. We were there when he fought Mark Hunt. We were there for the Coleman fights. We were there for all the great events that happened that led to the legend that became Fedor Emelianenko. And I really honestly just wanted to stay away because I knew what was going to happen. Wow. I knew what was going to happen. Fedor is slow. He's in shape for a 45-year-old man. That's, you know, he's got the dad body. He's always kind of rocked the dad bod.
But it's not the same dad bod as it was 10 years ago.
Exactly. So I kind
of
had this.
It's really more of a dad bod now.
It's like the real version of a dad bod now. I just had this sick sense, and not sixth. I mean sick. Like, I felt sick to my stomach.
I like it.
I knew that Fedor was going to end up bad. And we just saw it happen to, like, all these, you know, we saw it happen to Glover.
Just, well, you know what? We just did a whole Shogun wax poetically about how badass he was. And I think when we do these jests, one, it's the old combat sports fan in us. The same way that you would hear about guys sitting in barbershops in the 80s and talking about the greatness of Ali and what if Ali fought Tyson, these conversations that happened in the 90s on street corners and in boxing circles where people talked about what if De La Hoya fought a prime Sugar Ray Leonard, those type of conversations. And I think with Fedor and Shogun and these guys, you know, Vanderlei, and you see the photo afterwards of all these greats of the last 20 years shuffling into the cage, and Matt Hughes is there, and Chuck Liddell is there, and fucking Rampage is, it's just Boys all
Gracie
these
was there. I love that picture.
It's fan Mark Coleman, and you said it's just so dope. But at the same time, and again, I want to make sure we're doing this, Jess. I don't want to sound like the old guys in the barbershop as much as I want to try and educate the younger listeners, the kids that are under 25 that maybe have only been watching combat sports for 3 or 4 years, that caught on because of guys like Conor and are still kind of interested, even if the light is a little bit dimmer than it was. Their interest isn't as what it was 3 or 4 years ago, and maybe that changes now with Conor coming back and possibly a winnable fight, a stylistically fun fight. But I'm hoping here, Jess, that again, we're educating our younger listeners, but also giving our older listeners, our true combat sports listeners, the backbone of this show for so many years, that little bit of a taste of, yes, we remember, and he should never be discredited. And when they make that true Mount Rushmore of heavyweights, you got to put Fedor on there. You just absolutely have to. And you can't look at the last 7 or 8 years. It's easy to look at that, right? But what you got to look at is that 99, 2000, really 2000, like 2010 era, where he was just fucking unstoppable. And we wanted to see him fight Randy Couture. And we wanted those fights. And they just, they wouldn't happen because that's what we talk about on this show. Big enough. The money wasn't there. Dana and whoever, the people just weren't making it happen. And it was just smarter for Fedor to stay overseas, create his own promotions in Russia with shady individuals and get big payouts. That was just the smarter way for him to operate. And I don't like to do the what ifs, right? I don't like to do the what ifs as much as I just like to look at the totality of his work and go, yeah, in my opinion, the guy belongs on that heavyweight MMA Mount Rushmore. And we can always talk about who we would and wouldn't put on there. But in my opinion, you got to start with Fedor. He's got to be that guy.
Yeah, 100%. Jay, just out of curiosity, because you've been following the sport probably longer than I have, what is the first fight that comes to mind when you think of Fedor Emelianenko?
Semi Schilt, which is really, really aging, dating myself, right? Semi Schilt.
Fedor 2002.
Fought. Is that when that was? No, they fought before that. They fought before that. Are you sure?
Semi Schilt, 2002.
Okay. So here's the reason, because I was a big Semi guy.
Yeah.
And I thought this is just a guy in the way of, Semi fighting Nogueira, Semi fighting those real top flight UFC heavyweights. And Fedor fucking wrecked him. He wrecked him. I don't think he knocked him out. He just ground and pounded him. Did he finish that fight? Just hear me that?
No, it was a unanimous decision.
He just beat the absolute shit out of him. And that's when you saw the Fedor vicious ground and pound that was like something that you hadn't seen out of a ground and pound style fighter, where he just threw punches from the top mount that looked like they would knock out a fucking bear. Like, they were just so fierce. And he was doing it with power in both hands and the speed. Like, it was just... it was unbelievable. That's the first one that I remember. And then I remember thinking, oh, this guy could give Fedor some fits. And at that time, shout out to Chris W. Powers. He can tell you, we had these conversations on AOL messengers and message boards and ICQs or IQCs or whatever they were, where we would go, man, Fedor versus Nogueira. This is going to be fuck. These are the guys. These are the guys. And then you had that circle, Jess, that real trifecta of Fedor, Krokop, and Nogueira. And in 2002, if you were on SureDog, trust me, people weren't talking about Tim Sylvia. And no donk on Tim Sylvia. It's just those were like the three guys. Those were the guys. And then there was a lot of like, what if Josh Barnett could figure it out, and there was a lot of that, but man, those were the dudes. And Fedor fucked Nogueira up too in that first fight, man. He really did. He fucked Nogueira up.
For all the fans, I'll just call, I don't want to put a label of what kind of,
yeah, that fight's 20 years fans, old, by all the way, MMA fans. That fight's 20 years old. I'm thinking about it.
My first recollection of thinking, damn, this guy is dangerous, was actually his very next fight, which was against Heath Herring. Heath Herring was the big cowboy, the American, the Texan. He was the guy rocking the crazy hair, the shaved eyebrows.
Good wrestler.
Good wrestler, pretty strong guy. Not the most sophisticated striking. But
no, he was a good striker, though.
Definitely had hands.
Yes.
And Heath was supposed to be the guy that was to bring American MMA back to Japan. He was the guy that was like, this is the guy. He was very produced. Everybody put him out there. And Fedor, again, just wrecked his world.
Yeah.
It ended up being a doctor stoppage. Heath just got blown out of the water. It was quick. After that fight, which I believe was my first ever actual fight, seeing Fedor fight, Then after that, I went back and watched a bunch of his stuff after that. But that was the first fight that made me like just my eyes pop and say, man,
Yeah, do you have?
the UFC heavyweights aren't doing things like this guy's doing.
No, that was it. Do you have his his five fights right there, like the semi fight, the Heath Herring fight, the Nogueira fight has to be right after that.
Yeah, Nogueira was actually my second pick for Fedor fights that just kind of stick out in memory would be Fedor Big Nog 1. That was at Pride 25 in 2003.
Yeah, so that's pretty much right after
And
the
it
Herring
was
fight.
basically right after the Herring fight, but he'd already won a shit ton of fights up until that point.
Fedor wanted a tear where it was like a Zulu fight, a Yoshida fight, but then like a Crow Cop fight.
I
And then
mean,
like he then like a food like he would Fujita fight. Like he was just fucking fighting everybody.
he did, and again, for the fans who there's I saw on Twitter, obviously like a bunch of us like old school guys and gals were posting, Fedor's the goat, he belongs on I don't know if you want to say goat, but I love how we do a Mount Rushmore of certain athletes, and Fedor belongs on the Mount Rushmore of MMA athletes. He does. He's one of those faces, if not the first face you should see. But he went on a tear. Guys, he went after he beat Big Nog. He went and beat up Kazuyuki Fujita. He went and soccer kicked Gary Goodridge into another dimension. He then went and submitted Mark Coleman, and that was pretty quick. Coleman thought he'd be used his wrestling against Fedor. Fedor stuffed that, took him down, armbarred him bad. It looked like he was gonna break Coleman's arm off and take it home with him. And then I forget that he's actually fought in Big Nog 3 times.
Yeah, there's the DQ. Are you
Yes.
counting the DQ
Yes, I'm
fight?
counting the no contest fight. It
That
happened
was
with the accidental.
the first time that I can ever recall a Pride event ending with disappointment.
Yes.
Because they were always just fucking bangers. That was the one time where it's like, oh no, this is gonna end because of a fucking headbutt. And the Pride events were long too, just like UFC. It's like, oh damn, I just sat through 3.5 hours for. I've been fucking jazzed for this for 3 days because they would record them on like a Thursday in Japan. And you just had to avoid spoilers because there were spoilers back then. Shout out Dave Meltzer. You had to avoid WrestlingObserver.com for 2 days. You had to avoid SureDog.com for 2 days. And then you watch that fight and then you just say, oh damn, they just ended in a fucking headbutt. Yeah. No, but the second fight was the next fight. In my opinion, there's really two Fedor Nogueira fights, and Fedor won them both convincingly.
Yes. And to me, again, that goes back to saying that some of these fans out there will say, well, back in the UFC, you had this guy and this guy, and Fedor refused to
No.
fight them. I
Yeah.
don't see it that
There's
way.
weird revisionist history, Jess.
That
There's
obviously there is, but you have to
been a.
take into account of exactly what you just said. Fedor had started overseas. He had fought in rings in Brazil. He had fought in all over the world at this point in time. And now he's in Japan, where Pride is this up and coming big showmanship type show. The lights, the fireworks, the movie playing on the background of like basically their entire fighting life and career. I mean, they did everything so big. And then to have a guy that was so quiet, Fedor, that was the thing. That's the thing I will always remember
Yeah,
about Fedor.
he was the
He
opposite.
was the
Yep.
opposite of showmanship. He was quiet. He walked down to the ring like a robot.
And Jess, you have to understand part of what made Pride so badass was the showmanship and
Yeah.
not the guy talking shit, fighter A talking shit to fighter
No,
B.
no, no, no.
It was the coming down from the elevator, the light ramp, these LED ramps they would make with like 50 big screens. It was just such an absolute spectacle that I think it was more of the pro wrestling, WrestleMania, Royal Rumble
Yes.
type of video. Like, if these video screens and the stuff they were using, the presentation in 2001 and 2002 was just so fucking amazing.
And shout out to Lynn Hart,
Yes.
the screaming pride lady, as she's been so, commonly known and referred to. And we actually had there was a show where I believe that you were unable to go to. I actually had Justin Von Doom on as my co that night, and we got to interview Lynn Hart on
I know
this
this.
podcast. It was phenomenal. She's a phenomenal lady, and she belongs in that lore because just the way that she would just articulate the names, the rolling of the tongue, just the
It's
screaming part, it
the
was amazing.
she
But
posted on Instagram or she posted on Twitter a photo of her and Fedor from like 2002, and then a photo of her and Fedor from I think this past weekend. So it was so fucking cool. But yeah, Jess, listen, we will sit here and wax poetically about Fedor for an hour if people want us to. And again, we don't want to talk about the last 10 years because he just had weird fights that nobody cared about. Nobody cares about Paul Buonatello fights. Nobody cares about those fights. You want to
Yeah.
look at just the 10 years of just absolute excellence at a division where, and we talk about it all the time. We just did a big heavyweight show a few weeks ago, and we talked about, man, any of these guys could knock out anyone at any time because that's just how the heavyweight division is right now. Like, it's really so difficult to say Don is better than this guy or this guy is better than this guy because anyone can get it at 225 and above. And Fedor just, it wasn't happening. He just was so good at being unavailable for that big punch or when he did get slammed on his fucking head. And you'd think he's dead. He would just roll up and stand up and keep fighting. The guy was like, he made out of, he was Gumby. He's a rubber man. These are not stories we're making up. And again,
The
this is.
mongoose style, I consider it mongoose style of striking, like just that, like hands up, like that almost a Muay Thai type striking from the hands. To me, my favorite part about Fedor was the look on his face as he's standing across the ring from his opponent. I swear to you, and it might just be me, but he had this look on his face like he was sad for what he was about to do to this other man. It was just like almost like a serial killer look. Like he was
That's
like,
how I saw it more.
I
I
feel
saw it more
really
serial killer.
bad. I feel really bad for what I'm about to do to this guy over here. 'Cause he's not a bad dude, but I'm gonna go and kick the shit out of him.
To me, it was always more serial killer, Jess. That's
Yes.
just me personally. Jess, let's hop into this
Let's do it.
UFC. There's a card this weekend. We're only hitting the main card here, guys. We spent probably 10 minutes more than we planned talking about Fedor. But I mean, it's Fedor. All right, let's start at the bottom here, Jess. Jimmy Crute, he's taking on Alonzo Menifee. Could be one name to butcher somebody's name on this card. Jimmy Crute, Alonzo Menifee. Crute is a 230 favorite, Jess. Who you got?
I'm actually going with the underdog. I like Alonzo Menifield in this. He brings a lot of different skill sets to the cage. He's very, very athletic guy. He's got some hands. He's got some wrestling ability. I don't know much about Jimmy Crute. I've had to go back and look at a couple of like snippets of fights. He looks like a very aggressive fighter. I think that actually goes into Menifield's wheelhouse. I'm gonna go Menifield by decision.
Yeah, we just talked about popping the gloves and heavier weights, 205. This is one of those anything goes type fights. Wouldn't surprise me if either guy got a knockout early. I'm leaning the opposite way. I'm leaning Crute. He does have heavy hands. I think he's got good pop in his left. And I'm leaning Crute knockout. I'm going to go round one. Justin Taffa. He is a minus 140. He's from New Zealand. He is fighting Parker Porter. Parker Porter almost looks like the creative fighter heavyweight that you would just see right before you get to the actual UFC fighters, like the top 10 ranked guys. I mean, he's got the tattoos, he's bald.
He's got the goatee.
I hope I don't run into Parker Porter in a parking lot and he can just drop me on my fucking head. But with that said, Jesse, again.
I'm going with Taffa. He's just a tough dude, and he's got bombs in his gloves. I'm telling you, he's almost like a reimagined version of Mark Hunt. Not just
Yep.
because of the New Zealand style, but mostly because of the New Zealand style.
No,
He's
that's it. That
in
truly
that
is.
camp, and the guy's just got heavy, heavy hands. And if you watch some of his fights, he can definitely take a punch. I mean, I'm not saying he's got Mark Hunt's chin, but he's got a chin on him. Parker Porter looks like the creative version fighter that's about to get knocked out in the first round.
I like the idea of once again just wash, rinse, repeat here. These are two guys at heavyweights that are going to throw bombs, and whoever lands the first good combination or first real nice fast hook is probably going to take the quick advantage. And can you finish the guy? In agreeance here, Tafa's got the quicker hands. Haven't seen a ton of Porter clearly, but I'm going Tafa knockout round one. These are a little bit more recognizable guys here. Jack Della Maddalena, I am a fan. Yes. He is a minus 305 here, Jess, versus Randy Brown. I'm not sleeping on Randy Brown either here. He's no slouch, Jess. Who you got?
I don't think that people should sleep on Randy Brown. Matter of fact, if you're going to pull an undercard bet or an underdog bet, I would place money on Randy Brown.
Agreed.
Jack Della Maddalena, though, is one of these up-and-coming guys that just is so well-rounded. Just, he can throw things, and everything is perfectly timed. The kicks, the punches, the takedowns. I mean, his game plan never wavers in the middle of a fight. He's such a very high IQ fighter. I'm going to go Jack Della Maddalena. I'm going to go unanimous decision. But I'm going to go decision because I have respect for Randy Brown and just the pure toughness that that guy can bring to a fight.
Yeah, this feels like a 2 out of 3 rounds here, and I'm going to lean Jack. Maybe Randy's able to keep it stagnant, standing, land something here and cruise with some momentum and steal 2 out of 3. But I like Jack standing. I think he's a little bit more advantageous with his grappling as well. This could be one of those fights where we end up seeing a rematch of these guys 2 or 3 years down the road. This is not a stock up versus stock down fight. And again, just like Jess said, if you're looking for a good underdog bet, nothing wrong with Randy Brown here. I'd probably throw a little 20 on it. I like where Jess's head at. Again, with that said, we're all leaning Jack Della Maddalena. We've reached the co-main event, Jess. I am confused by this co-main event, and I wanted to start here. So it's an interim featherweight title belt. So does that mean that Volk is giving up the title? Wasn't Volk the 145 belt, or how does the featherweight under lightweight? I'm fucking confused, Jess.
I'm trying to remember featherweight. I think fanweight is right above bantam, or am I confused? Both are under lightweight, so.
Listen, I'm making it happen right now.
Yeah,
it's where the hell they
is go? It 135?
Let's see it right here. Here it is. Actually, blew it. Flyweight's 115. Bantamweight's 135. Wow, featherweight's 145.
Okay, so 115. We got some lightweights in this.
So no, but if featherweight is 145, then that means that fucking what's his name is dropping his belt. That means Volk's going up, right? Because Volk was the featherweight.
Volk is in this fight. Now, here's the thing that confuses me about this. Volkanovski is the featherweight champion, and he's dropping the featherweight title. What happens if he loses? Like, don't most people go in belt-on-belt type situation? Yeah, like, at least if you lose, you still got a belt to take
home
with you.
They didn't take the 185 belt off of Izzy when he lost to John. So what the fuck are we doing here?
So, again, there's been a lot of weird shit going on in the UFC.
Is this one of those stupid things where whoever wins this fight is going to fight fucking Volk? Regardless, unless Volk beats Islam, which I don't know. We'll get there in a second. All right, Jess. So now we've only confused ourselves more, other than we know featherweight is slightly above lightweight. Yeah. Yair is a slight dog to Josh. Yes, Josh. I just made Josh Emmett fucking. I just made him Brazilian. So you're welcome. You're welcome, Josh Emmett. We got.
You know what, Josh? Is a strange character, man. When he first kind of burst on the scene, a lot of people thought that he was going to be, I think he was fighting lightweight at the time. People thought that he was going to challenge, if not eventually win the lightweight championship. Just never happened. Injuries happened. Weird fights happened. He came in and out of wins and losses. Now he's been on a little bit of a tear as a featherweight. I think it definitely suits him better. He's going to be the stronger guy in this fight. But I'm telling you, I can't trust the guy who's so iffy in and out of wins and losses. I got to go with Yair. I love what Yair has, the just the style, the skill set. Like, he's a tough dude again. Like, he's just one of those tough guys. He reminds me of, I mean, I know you got like the Hispanic background and stuff, but he reminds me of Moreno. Mm-hmm. Just this guy who can throw stuff at different angles and just catch people. He's got good submission skill set. Josh Emmett is going to have two dimensions. One is he's going to fuck Yair into out of existence. That's the base for all Emmett's wins. Number two is he's going to try to slug it out with Yair. And if he can do that and connect, I do believe that Emmett is the stronger, more powerful puncher. If he can get that connection, I can see him winning that way. But Yair is smart. He's aggressive when he needs to be aggressive. And he backs off and judges the fight when he needs to back off. I think Emmett is going to try to charge. Yair is going to play that defensive game and push him somewhere in the second, third, fourth round. And I'm going with a Yair TKO win over Emmett.
Man, the more I look at this fight, and I also want to say this to you, Jess, quick side note. I was in the car at 10 a.m. this morning, and I decided, and I was thinking to myself, I still don't have a definitive Super Bowl winner, and I'm supposed to record this show with Jesse. Yeah. Like, I think I know now, but like at 10 a.m. this morning, I was like, man, I'm not sure if I'm confident with my pick today, but now I am. So that's kind of how I feel with this fight, looking at it and thinking about it as you're fleshing it out for me. I don't know if Yair has as many ways to win this fight as Emmett does, because I think Yair has to win this fight by being Bull Matador. I think he has to win this fight by just being able to dance, stay outside, use straight punches, straight kicks, and just beat Emmett up. Now, can I see that happening, and can I agree with what you're saying? Yes. I don't want to say easily, but I can see a way where Yair just beats Josh to a pulp and stops him with just high kicks and switch kicks and shit like that. Because Emmett's just not able to catch him. But I also think Emmett can win this fight two ways. One is in that foam booth style of fight, that true Bull Matador, because I think Emmett throws really, really good hooks. And when he's inside of your reach, he's really good at rolling and hitting you with a nasty left hook. We've seen him knock guys out with that left hook. So I think he can give Yair real fits if he can make it that phone booth fight. And I also think he's the better grappler. I think if this turns into just a straight up grappling match, he can give Yair a few more fits with top control and overall aggressiveness, because I believe he's just a little bit of a heavier cat than Yair. So I can see it. So here's where I'm leaning. I'm not gonna lie. I'm gonna go all in. I think Emmett wins this fight 3-2. I think he controls round 4 and 5 with grappling, with pumping him up against the cage and wearing Yair down. And I think Yair can play Bull Matador for two, possibly 3 rounds. But somewhere later in this fight, I think is where Emmett really starts to lay the groundwork. He's just got to steal one of those first 2 rounds. And if he can finish 4 and 5 with just grappling, which is what I believe he'll do, I think he's going to wear Josh out. I'm sorry, he's going to wear Yair out. I like Josh, unanimous decision, 5 rounds. We've got our light title bout, our heavyweight championship. You know, it's been, we've already made fun of Dana countless times on the internet, on this show. But the fact that he really couldn't get to this main event shows the gravity of it, if you will, which is unfortunate because this is a test for Volk, who's really testing himself and going up and fighting an absolute savage in Islam. This is a great fight on paper. And to watch Dana kind of struggle through the 1 or 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. press conference, could not remember who the fuck was fighting on this card. It's a bit of a slap in the face.
Can we really blame him at this? Okay, there's a lot of things we can blame Dana White on. But let's be real. This guy's been up all day. He's probably like, the coke is finally starting to wear off a little bit. Like, he's
got a fucking monster with him. You're drinking a monster 2-3 in the morning. You've already made some bad decisions. So fucking, I think I'm good with him going, fuck it. Yeah, that, yeah.
And the fact that it's not like, you know, Smith is fighting Jones. I'm sorry to say that the way, but like, come on, man. 3:30 in the morning, everything's kind of dying down.
Just like, remember Islam, and just remember Volk. Just have somebody write it down on a piece of paper and stick it in front of you. Because you know that question's going to come. It's a question they've got to say. At some point, someone's got to say, hey, wrapping this up, this was tremendous. Now moving on to next Saturday, give me some thoughts. And then you look at that fucking sheet of paper and go, Volk, Islam. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great fight. Fucking Volk's going up. Islam's the champ. So no odds on UFC.com. I don't know if you got any odds, Jess. You got odds on this fight?
I see Islam a minus 410. So he's,
serious?
Yeah, he's pretty big favorite in this fight.
Holy fuck. They're not giving me that on UFC.com. I wonder why. He's the biggest fucking favorite on the card.
And what's funny is I believe that Volkanovski is by far his toughest competition to date. And to be that big of a favorite, I think, is almost a slap in the face of Volk and all the things that he's been able to accomplish. I mean, think about he's beaten some. He's beaten some everybody. Monsters.
He's beaten everybody.
And to come in and be,
this on paper has on paper could be a great fight. But I now we will truly find out how much of a steamroll Islam truly is. But who you got, Jess?
I'm going to shock the world. I'm going with the underdog.
Wow.
I'm taking Volkanovski. He's got very good grappling. He's got good strikes. I get it. He's going to be the smaller man, like the shorter man, shorter reach guy in the cage. But he's fought everybody at that same level. He's had that, you know, those disadvantages in every fight. He's never fought a guy that's his size. And Islam is going to be the bigger, you know, probably stronger, lengthier fighter.
Yeah, that means a lot of this weight division.
This is not the first time Volk has fought this type of fight. Volkanovski's got everything in the tool belt that he needs to win this fight. To me, this is a fight that Volk doesn't have to win, even Islam does. Islam is the one looking for legendary status. He's the one that's looking for, you know, he wants to be his own namesake. He wants to be, you know, Khabib. He wants to be Conor. He wants to have this namesake. Islam needs to beat Volk. Volk doesn't need to be Islam. And I think that gives Volk an edge in this fight as well, because the pressure is on the opposite side of the cage. Volkanovski is going to go in there. He's going to play the phone booth game. He's going to tie Islam up. I'm not saying it's going to work all five rounds, but I think it's going to work for at least three out of the five rounds, and he's going to squeak out a win, and he's going to put Islam semi back into his place, where he's going to have to come up with a different game plan for the next time.
The only way I can see Volk winning this fight is if Islam does one of those, or is if Islam makes a mistake. If Islam says, I'm going to try and stand with this guy, I'm going to test myself, I want to see where my stand-up game is at this division, even though it could be risky. Because, the 10 pounds isn't much, but it's just enough, Jess. And you know that. Because you know Islam's probably coming down from 175 or something stupid. Now, I know Volk used to be fat, used to be a heavy guy, trained with heavier guys and all that shit, fought at heavier weights. But it's just such a drastic difference, and I think the fights we've seen recently, especially in the last year or two, where people try and go up, it just does, and they're fighting guys that are naturally cutting, it just never fucking ends well. And I don't think it ends well here for Volk. Now again, maybe Islam is just drinking so much of his Kool-Aid, he just looks at this and goes, this is light work, I'm gonna go in there, I'm gonna put on a clinic box in, I'm gonna stand with them, I'm gonna show guys what I can do with my hands. That would be a mistake, because Volk will catch him. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think Islam's going to fucking get in there, take him down, use that grappling, use that top flight submission that he has, next level submission skill, and the way, you know, that Khabib, aka pressure, that those guys apply, it's just fucking next level, Jess. And I don't think Volk makes it two rounds. I don't. I think this is a bad stylistic matchup. But again, this is also me I you know me, I bought the Islam stock. I'm all in. I think he's the future. I think a lot of these dudes from that camp are the future. You and I have talked about this. I'm all in. I somebody wants to argue that that Khabib, that AKA branch right now, where it's basically Khabib and his homies, you know, they are the future. They've got nothing but champions coming out of it. I mean, yeah, I don't see how you argue against that. I don't think Volk makes it out of three rounds. I'm going to say two, but I don't think he makes it out of three.
The thing that I want to put like a point on this fight is that the UFC, a lot of us have complained, you and I have complained about the fact that there's not stars right now being made in the UFC. You know, we're recycling John Jones. We're recycling a bunch of guys that have, you know, been in the fight game for 10, 12 years. You know, a lot of these guys, you know, like Volk and like Islam and just some of these other guys that are coming up in the game, even Jack Della Maddalena, like we were talking about earlier, these are the stars. And I am baffled as to why the UFC cannot promote these men and women properly. Like Chuck Liddell was on, you know, Pepsi commercials and shit back in the day. Like, why are these guys not getting opportunities to have their names put out there?
I think
these are the stars in the future of the UFC, and there's multiple divisions of them. Weight divisions.
Let's see some promotion. This is the international pros and cons, if you will, of the UFC being an international sport. Is maybe Volk has big commercials and has big endorsements in the country he's from. And maybe Islam has big promotions and commercials from the countries that he resides in. But from an American perspective, and you know us, we don't see them as big stars. And I think you can always make that argument, Jess, right, that a lot of these fighters come to the UFC to have that American exposure, right? To have that, they want to be, you know, worldwide stars. And part of being a worldwide star is having American recognition. Do those guys have it outside of the UFC? No, they don't. Now, whose fault is that? Is that Dana's fault for doing a bad job of cross promoting? Is that ESPN's fault? Is that how far up the ladder do we go where we go, these guys aren't doing the cross promotion that they will? Meanwhile, what do you see when we're watching the UFC? Well, Tony Khan's smart enough to stick MJF in the stands with his AEW belt so he can get his, so he can get a little bit of a 2 second rub. And fucking, this guy's coming out with an album in 2 weeks, so he's fucking sitting there next to whoever, getting his 2 seconds, and they're saying, oh, look, you know, so-and-so got an album coming out here. And then what do they have next after in between fights? Oh, Johnny Depp's sitting here, and we're going to show a preview for Johnny Depp's next movie coming up here. You know, stay tuned for that. They know how to cross-promote, Jess. Do they care to? Do they bother to? It's a whole nother question.
I still think that, again, this is just me, and I know that you feel the same way, but like, this is just me being pro fighter. These guys are prize fighters. They are out to make some money. If they can make a name for themselves, that's even better. If they can win a championship on the way, that's even better. But the bag is what they're for. That's what puts food on their table. That's what provides their mortgage. That's what pays their car payment. You know what I mean? That's what pays their coaches, their training staff, the gym that they train in. So the more cross promoting that happens, I mean, for gosh sake, I just saw Kamaru Usman, I just saw Usman on a.
He's in the Black Panther.
Yeah, Black Panther. I just watched him on Black Panther. He had like three lines. But he got paid a couple bills for it, I guarantee you.
Three more lines than any UFC fighter.
So why is Volkanovski not in a damn Avengers movie or something? I mean, he looks like he could be a bad guy in an Avengers movie. Hell, Islam looks like he could be a bad guy in an Avengers movie. Let's stick them all in Avengers movies.
They got 100 of them.
You do work for the Mickey Mouse Club. I mean, let's make some stuff happen here.
So, Jess, to take it a layer deeper, okay? Do you think the UFC wants these guys cross promoting, wants these guys finding out that their value is more than what the UFC keeps. There could be.
A side note is we are just now seeing a Jorge Masvidal production coming out where Anthony Pettis is going to fight Roy Jones Jr. But yet Masvidal fighting on a UFC card here in a couple months. So like, how
I don't know. I want to see all those guys get paid before I even believe that all, because I saw four fights where I'm like, okay, they're really gonna have all.
Although
four
it's
of these
Jeremy
fights.
Stevens gonna be boxing. That's crazy.
There was like a bunch where like Pearl Gonzalez was fighting like Paige VanZant. They were like good fights where I'm like, they have the money. So either these fighters are taking small purses, or I don't know what the fuck they're taking. But to me, it is. Listen. That to me is if it smells like a fish, if it smells fishy, it could be fishy. That would have made just smells a little bit too fishy. But Jess, again, not to get too deep into
the
hairs. We always want fighters to get paid.
We want them. We want to get the money.
We spent 40 full minutes doing some MMA topics here. We're not going to talk about Derek Lewis losing 25, 30 pounds, only to disappoint everybody who stayed up till 1 in the morning to watch him lose again. We're not talking about that tournament of young fighters, which is actually really beneficial to the UFC. And I hope they do more of those moving forward with those lighter weights, because it reminded me of the Pride Bushido type of tournaments that they used to do with the lighter weights. We'll talk about that next week. We got one more football game to talk about, Jess. Also, we should probably talk about Sean Payton. I don't know. We got things that we're missing. Real quick NBA hit, Jess. We want to talk some LeBron. We want to talk some Kyrie. You and I did this podcast a few years ago, and I remember specifically coming right off of that trade. It happened either day of or day after, and we did a recording. And I know specifically, I said, these Nets, they're probably good for one championship. They're going to be together for 5 years here. There's just too much talent when you've got a KD, a Kyrie. They didn't even have Harden yet. It was just rumored they were getting Harden. And then they went through a Harden cycle and then a Simmons cycle. And Jess, I think you might have agreed with me. I think you were in it. I think we both were just like, yeah, I'm probably going to win one. That RIP, the NWO Nets. We nicknamed them the NWO Nets, the black and white. They were hated by everybody. KD was showing up with NWO jackets. And they ended up, and I know the stats are out there. I think they played like 100 games together collectively. Like, they didn't even play two or three full seasons together. And they lost to the Giannis Bucks. They lost to the Celtics, the Boston Celtics. They always lost to the eventual champions of the East, but they just couldn't get it done. Kyrie has now been shipped to Dallas, and we'll touch on that in a second, Jess. But let's start here, Jess. Give me some initial thoughts on the NWO Nets and the RIP to them.
So we live in a world of sports where you no longer have like the one star and then multiple like role guys built around that one star. You know, now we have to have 3-4 all-stars on a team, and that's just how things are going.
If you're gonna win,
you want 3-4 guys who can contribute nightly. That's gonna make your push towards a championship run. That's why we were in on the Nets at least getting one ship, because how could you say that they wouldn't? With the talent that they had, the role players that they had, the coaching staff that they had.
We kept saying they have two of the five best players in the world. You could argue they had two of the five best players in the world.
Yeah. I mean, you can say what you want about Kyrie and all the personal stuff, but as a basketball player, he is top notch. You know, he's right under the Steph Curry category. Steph Curry's like out of world point guard stuff. Curry is like right underneath that. So, I mean, that's just the way it is. Or Kyrie Irving is. So I figured that with that much talent, and the fact that KD, all props to LeBron for doing everything that he's done for the 20 years that he's been in the league. But I have never, outside of Michael Jordan, and I possibly think that KD is a better scorer than Michael Jordan. I don't think I've ever seen such a natural scorer than Kevin Durant. You combine that with Kyrie Irving and his passing ability, his defensive ability, and his ability to take over a game and score as well. And then again, with the role players and everything that they had on that team, they had guys like Spencer Dinwiddie for a few years and some other guys.
They had that first year.
Yeah. So I just figured they were good for one championship. And it did not happen. It did not come to fruition. It's the one notch in the let's get three or four all-star guys together that just didn't pan out. And other teams have done it and other teams have lost, but I don't think it's had the impact that the Nets have had in their ways of losing. I mean, they went through some really weird spells on that team. There's a lot of hate in the locker room going on. Mm-hmm. There was Kyrie's, you know, well, the world was flat. There was some other stuff going on. It's super weird.
That's it. There was a lot of cause and effect caused by Kyrie. It was the anti-vax stuff. It was the missing games because he wanted to go to people's birthday parties. It was the comments that he'd make, the flippant comments, and then he was out. He wanted to be traded. He wanted to be traded. He's going to the Lakers. He's going to the Lakers. And then he's going. It just never seemed like he was fully committed. And I heard JJ Redick say something interesting this morning, which he said, you know, majority of guys in the locker room, they just want a ball. That's it. They just want a ball. They're not there for the politics. They're not there for the preaching. They're not there for the prayer circles. They're there to ball. They just want to show up, ball, go home, get their checks, and keep it moving. And when you have that one center distraction that's constantly pulling you away from just ball, because you've got to answer Kyrie questions every night, once every other week, because he's doing something, saying something, that's just taking you away from ball. And at some point, I don't know. I think at some point you KD, and clearly not just the ownership, but KD had to go, all right, this is enough. I'm fucking over it. I'm over it. Like I want to just ball, and this is the one thing keeping me from just balling. They bring in James Harden, right? And then James Harden all of a sudden is going from, man, I just want to ball, to, man, I'm answering a lot of vaccination questions. Man, I'm answering a lot of Kyrie questions. Kyrie is probably an acquired taste that KD was good with, and James Harden just was not. And then you hear the stories of Harden and Kyrie started to not get along, and then Kyrie just became a shitty teammate to him and just was smoking him every day in practice. And calling him out of shape, calling him fat. Like that type of shit. Like that's not a good teammate. That's a bad teammate. I'm sorry. I don't understand. It is what it is. They go through this cycle now where they get Ben Simmons. And I mean, I just don't know how you look at that team and go, all right, this is a championship team when teams have just gotten better in the East. And I think at some point, the thought process is, man, just roll the ball out. And again, even this year, right, before the trade happens, you go, man, you get a healthy KD, you get a healthy Kyrie. Nick Claxton is playing at an all-time level defensively. He's fucking DeAndre Jordan this year. Let's roll the ball out. And again, hey, like we talked about at the beginning of this show, Jess, all we got to do is win 4 out of 7 of these games. That's it. I think we got two of the top five talents, top eight talents in the world. Like, we got a shot. And Kyrie, for whatever reason, it just wasn't happening. Now, there's a lot of talk, Jess, basically, hey, the ownership came to Kyrie and said, we are putting stipulations in your contract. What those stipulations are, who fucking knows? There are a lot of young NBA players with stipulations in their contract that people don't talk about. Who gives a shit? They're still signing them, still making a lot of money. Kyrie refused to sign these contracts, said, deal me on a Friday, and he was dealt on a fucking Sunday, Jazz. They got that guy out of there in 48 hours. Any thoughts now, Jess, on the trade process, on him getting flipped so quickly, on the exit? What are you thinking here?
I think that the obvious sign is this. If you look at the way the trade happened, Yes, the Nets got a couple of like really solid players from Dallas. Okay, so they're getting some guys from Dallas that I think are manageable guys come in. They're gonna play their game. They're gonna play defense. Some guys can score. They're gonna get along well with KD, and I think that the Brooklyn Nets will not be contenders in the East with these guys, but I think that they will become a better team, especially if KD likes the surface of this franchise now better, and he decides to stick around for a few more years, maybe even finish his career off in Brooklyn. Who knows? But if you look at what Brooklyn took outside of the players, everybody was saying they're going to get multiple first round draft picks. It's going to be nuts. Like it's big, one of the biggest trades in the NBA. And I think that Dallas got away with giving them like two or three second round picks, one of which isn't good until 2029. Like
Who knows who's going to be alive then?
Brooklyn simply wanted to just deal him. And that's the proof. The proof is in the deal. Dallas gets an all-star point guard to go along with Luka. I don't know how that's gonna manage itself out.
That was going to be my final question about
That
this,
we'll
Justin.
get to
Go
that in
ahead.
a minute, but as far as the trade goes, I think that in a way it was good. It was really good for Brooklyn, and it was just good for Dallas. I know Dallas fans will disagree because they're looking at what they're getting as a player, but there's other things involved that Dallas fans may not like in the next 3 to 6 months, and they may think differently of this trade in 3 to 6 months. But Brooklyn now has free space in that locker room to have more conversation, just go out and, like you said, just go and ball, just play ball, just go out there, team ball it up, let KD take his shots, get some other guys involved. I think that it will work and run as a more cohesive unit, seeing how Kyrie was kind of the odd man out in that locker room. Now, as far as the Dallas stuff goes, I'm just going to pitch my thought in real quick and say I like it because now Luka has a guy that can take some pressure off of him during the game. But again, two so different personality types. Luka is this, hookah smoking, Philly cheesesteak eating like kid who just wants to go have fun. Like he's one of those guys, the few guys in the league that is so incredibly talented, but does not use that for any bad. He just wants to go on the court and have fun. He loves his teammates. He probably barbecues it up with Mark Cuban on the weekends. He goes back to Croatia or wherever he's from and he chills with a bunch of chicks in one of those ice caves and drinks liquor. Like he just wants to have a good time.
Living the dream.
And now you bring in Kyrie, who's got kind of baggage. Like, I mean, let's just be real. He's got some baggage. And now you become more of a serious locker room because you have to kind of watch your P's and Q's around, like, well, how do I approach Kyrie? Or what if he approaches me with this question? Or what if he's on the court and he's trying to smoke me? And I mean, let's be real. Like, having Luka and Kyrie on the court is crazy trouble for the opposition. But in practice, how's that going to look?
Yeah, a few things here. So one, I agree with you with Brooklyn. I think now you've got, if you get Dinwiddie, you keep Dinwiddie. You don't turn around and flip him because he's a flippable asset. You go, all right, KD, we've got some guys here, and you are now officially the guy. There is no sharing the rock. You're shooting 20 fucking times. We are playing KD centric ball. Now, whether he chooses to stay there or not, whether he chooses to roll with that, we'll see at the end of the year, right? He's asked to be traded just as many times as Kyrie, so time will tell. Now, with regards to the Dallas trade, yeah, they were going to get 50 cents on the dollar. It was clear that they were just trying to get rid of him. Every team knew this. Every team knew he wanted to go to LA. So the Nets made sure to completely overpick and overprice Kyrie in that market, knowing that they wouldn't be able to make that trade because LA wasn't going to give that much up. And then take the next best offer, which is what Dallas gave up. They're good with getting Dinwiddie because they're familiar with them. They're good with getting a few picks. And Dorie Smith is an asset as well. Now, to pick up back up on what you were saying, the chemistry will be where it's at, right? And it's going to take them at least 20, 25 games to figure that out. Like, It really does. You know me, I've been saying this to you forever, Jess. It takes a full season. It takes an 82-game season for a team to truly get the chemistry of we practice every day. We fly together every day. We eat meals together. We're really getting to know each other. We're getting to know what we like and what we don't like, where we like the ball, our offhands, our sweet spots, our not-so-sweet spots. That takes time to figure out, and it's going to be difficult to figure that out with whatever it is, 40 games left. Not impossible, because Luka is just so elite, and so is Kyrie. And kind of is the same thing that you had in Brooklyn, right? You have two of the top five players in the league. There's no, in my opinion, right now, you look at Kyrie, he's still a top five to top eight player in the league. And statistically, he's the highest fourth quarter scoring player in the league this year. That holds a ton of merit, especially when Luka starts to get tired in that fourth quarter, right? You see, you sit him maybe with 4 or 5 minutes, you know, from minute 12 to minute 8, let him get some air in those lungs, right? Guy's been fucking hitting that hookah, sipping on good long beers. Let him get his gas back up in the tank while Kyrie cooks and takes over. But my question is this, Jess, and this isn't a question to you as much as it is just a general question. What happens in the last five possessions? What happens in the last 3 minutes? Who's the guy? Who's deferring to who? Is it Kyrie deferring to Luka, or is it Luka deferring to Kyrie? This is not a Golden State style offense where Luka's going to be running around and zigzagging, finding ways to get open, to spot up. And Kyrie definitely ain't doing that shit. This is the James Harden Houston Rockets style of offense that Kyrie is used to playing in, and the offense we've been seeing Luka play the last 2 years. I'm gonna bring the ball up. I'm gonna hold on to this ball for possibly 12 out of the 24 seconds of the shot clock, which are the first 8 seconds and the last 8 seconds. Whatever y'all want to do in the middle is either pass the ball around, shoot the ball, or get it back to me. That's how it works. Now, whether him and Kyrie can work cohesively, that's the question. Can they beat a team in the first round? Yeah, because they just got a ton of talent. Can they beat a team in the second round? I don't know. They were able to do it last year because you had guys like Dinwiddie and everybody just buying into the Luka thing. They were all buying into the Luka thing. And like I talked about last year, Jess, also buying into, we're just going to shoot 63s a game.
I was just thinking about this conversation.
And if we make 20 of them, we're going to be in these games, right? And that's the thing with Kyrie as well. He's a pretty good 3-point shooter. So they'll be all right. You know what I mean? If they just exchanged a great 3-point shooter for another great 3-point shooter with triple the ball handles, triple the basketball IQ. Yeah, that's really what you're doing when you're doing Dinwiddie for Irving, right? Then we've got some play. But honestly, Jess, and we'll get into football now. I just don't know if they can get past Denver, if they can get past the Warriors, if they can get past the Grizzlies. I don't know, because you're not going to have that same team that you had last year where you got 11 guys and the coach buying into Luka, and Luka's the guy, and we just get out of his way. It's going to be different when Kyrie's there.
No, I agree. I think that there's just like in life, you know, if you want to use the alpha and the beta, you know, type thing. And I don't believe that Kyrie's ever been the alpha on a basketball team. You know, when he was in Cleveland, LeBron was the clear alpha, and Kyrie did what LeBron wanted. LeBron's got such a strong personality. He's so strong-willed that, you know, Kyrie's, you know, hijinks may have even been happening back then, but LeBron was like, hey, man, you're going to sit down. You're going to play basketball the way I want you to play basketball, or maybe I get you traded to, you know, the Atlanta Hawks. You know what I mean? Like, and Kyrie's like, okay, we're going to do this your way. In Brooklyn, you know, Kyrie came over with a head on his shoulders trying to be the alpha. But we all know that KD is the alpha on that team. And again, Kyrie had to kind of sit down. So when an alpha starts seeing the beta trying to cause problems, that alpha is going to get rid of the beta immediately. And that's exactly what's been going on. I think KD's want to be traded times were based on, hey, man, I'm tired of having to deal with all this stuff. And so it all revolves around one guy. You know, and so now what we're seeing in Dallas, I don't believe that Luke is an alpha player, and that's only based on personality. What I see him being, he's a kid playing a game, and I love that. And I think that the league loves that, and the fans love that. But now we could have a little conflict of personality type with Kyrie and Luka in the same locker room. Or what could happen, best case scenario, is Luka just brushes everything off his shoulders and says, fuck it, man, I'm just here to play. And Kyrie can say whatever he wants. I really don't. It doesn't bother me. That's the best case scenario.
I think it is now time, Jess. We're going to hit the, we were going to do LeBron. We'll save LeBron for next week.
We'll save LeBron.
We're running late. LeBron's not going anywhere. We both agree he's going to...
He'll be here for another 5 years.
At very least. He'll be playing with his son. Jess, I'm pulling up the odds right now here. We are, for the very last time in a very long time, I'm guessing here, going to thelines.com, and they are giving us all of your favorite gambling websites, but it doesn't matter because all of the your favorite gambling websites all have the same spread. It's 1.5. It's the Philadelphia Eagles. They are the favorite. They are playing the Kansas City Chiefs. They're in Arizona, as Jesse started the show talking about. Jess, who you got? Look, for the very last time this football season, wow. who
We've
you
done a
got?
Whole entire football season again. This is crazy. I'm basing this off of the way that I saw two teams play. So I saw the Kansas City Chiefs. They struggled. They've struggled this season at times. Not even just against the more elite teams. They struggled against like some of the more simpler teams. Even in coming up, like they had a good record. I get that. They still have Pat Mahomes. I get that. They still have Travis Kelce. I get that. The offense is still going to play the same, but the defense doesn't look as mean as it has in the past. The offensive line looks like a square peg in a round hole. Like I don't think I've seen Mahomes quite run around as much as he's had to run around. And, you know, the ankle injury was just a part of the offensive line breaking down faster than Mahomes could figure out a play and get rid of the ball. Mahomes' ankle looks fine. I saw them go in there and blast the Bengals in the mouth. And that's great. But even against Cincinnati, in that AFC Championship game, they struggled at times. Against this Philadelphia Eagles defense, you cannot struggle. This offense is going to have to be a pristine, well-oiled machine because this Eagles defense gets after everybody. Their secondary plays super physical off the line. Their defensive front, their front seven are so physical, and they just push people around, and they are nasty about it. Like, they don't just push guys down or knock a guy down. Like, they will drive people into the dirt. This is why I say that I'm picking the Philadelphia Eagles. I'm taking the points. A point and a half, I got that all day. I got at least a 3-6 point win by the Philadelphia Eagles in the Super Bowl. Nick Sirianni's got this team on lock right now. Jalen Hurts has played the ultimate underdog role since college ball. Talk about a guy who started off as the savior in Alabama, gets booted for Tua, goes to Oklahoma, plays well there, but not quite as well as people had imagined, gets drafted, goes to the Eagles, the city of brotherly love, the ultimate underdog city, right? Rocky Balboa. And he has performed extremely well, and he's carrying that underdog role all the way into the Super Bowl, where I think that Jalen Hurts will get the Philadelphia Eagles a Super Bowl ring.
Such a weird year for everybody but Philly. And I hate the idea of leaning on, you know, the Niners just didn't have a quarterback for three and a half quarters. Therefore, they never had a fair shot. But it's the defense's job to knock your quarterback on his ass and 100%. Put him out of the game. And that's exactly what Philly did. I was told by a room full of people how wrong I was on Philly's front seven. And, yeah, I'm here to eat that crow. Their front five, their front seven, it's fucking phenomenal. They're fast. You know, statistically, the sack numbers are all there. And then, you know, they've just got one elite defensive back. But when your front seven plays the way that it does, and that you know, the front four doesn't really need a blitz because they're just so nasty, with a banged up Kansas City offensive line, how many years are we going to talk about Kansas City's banged up offensive line at a Super Bowl? How about another one here? With Mahomes on a bad wheel, it's a recipe for disaster for Philadelphia, up big. And I think this feels to me like it gets away from Kansas City late. I can see this like a 10 or a 13 point game. I just hope it's competitive. I hope we don't get Philly doing what it's done the entire fucking playoff run here, which is just punch a team in the mouth and that's it. But it's in play. It's in play. Kansas City's got to find a way to keep their offense on the field. They've got to find a way to get those receivers balls. They've got to find a way to, you know, find someone other than Kelsey. And Mahomes has got to find a way to protect his bad leg. You're just asking too much out of Kansas City. I like Philly. I like the points. I think Philly wins by a ton. I hate Philly. I hate the Philadelphia Eagles. So, as a Cowboys fan, it hurts me to say. Jess, I'm gonna throw some fucking random, just some random stuff at you here before we get out of here.
All right, let's do this.
And that's it. All right, Jalen Hurts over under 238.5 yards passing.
Under.
Yeah, it's kind of high, right? Over under passing attempts for Jalen Hurts 31.5.
Ooh, under.
Yeah, that feels high. Under. Right?
That's like a Mahomes number. That's not a Jalen Hurts number.
That, I'm gonna get to Mahomes next. If he's throwing that, they're behind.
Yeah.
So I don't like that.
No.
Mahomes over under passing 290.5.
At half?
290.5.
Oh, yo, I'm going over.
Yeah, yeah.
Even with a great defense, he's gonna find ways to get yards.
To get 320.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting one. Over and a half, 1.5 touchdowns passing for Mahomes.
Over.
Okay. Miles Sanders over under rushing yards, 55 yards.
I'm gonna take the over, not by much. He's not like rushing for 100 yards. He's not gonna have to, but I'll take 60 to 65.
I actually like the 55.5. I think he goes over. Here's a fun one. His longest attempt. Will Miles Sanders' longest attempt be over or under 13.5 yards?
Under.
Really? You don't think he breaks one?
I don't think he breaks nothing super long.
I like 8, 9, 10, 11 yards.
Nah,
he's got a good. I think he's got a 15 yarder in him at least. I want to, okay, Kelsey time. Over-under receptions made for Kelsey, 5.5, Jess.
Oh, over.
They got to go over if they're going to have a fucking chance.
Triple that.
I feel like if they set it at 7.5, I'd still go over.
They had it at 10.5, I'd go over.
Over-under receiving yards for Kelsey, 79.5.
Over.
See, he catches a lot of short shit. So 79.5.
He's also one of those tight ends that he's good for yak. He will break a tackle or two.
Here's a good one. This is the last one, Jess. AJ Brown. And by the way, I'm going all chips in the middle, AJ Brown, Super Bowl MVP. So you want to go ahead and crown that bitch right now, I'm telling you. My Super Bowl MVP is going to be AJ Brown. It's not going to be Hurts because Hurts got fuck around throwing an interception or fumble a ball here. It's going to be Brown. And I'm going to go over on all these. Over under receptions made 4.5 for AJ Brown.
Over.
Well over. Over under receiving yards, 70.5.
Over.
Fuck, guys, I catch like at least a 30 or a 40 yard bomb, which is one more. Over under longest reception at 25.5 yards.
Over. He's going to break at least two.
So you want to fucking throw a little trifecta and really whip your dick out and make some money, guys? You go every over on AJ Brown. You take his over on his receiving. You take his over on his receptions. You take his over on his fucking longest catch.
And I love your pick too for Super Bowl MVP because let's face it. Here's the thing: the reason Mahomes is going to have 30 plus passing attempts because they're going to be playing from behind. He's going to have to pass the ball. It's simple. It's simple NFL mathematics, right? Hurts is going to be under because they're going to be playing over the whole game. But as far as receptions go, is Hurts will have, you know, 215, 220, 120 of that's going to be AJ Brown. Like they're not going to pass. They're not going to pass to Goddard more than two or three times. The running backs aren't going to get 15 passes. The running backs are going to run. Goddard's going to get two or three catches for like maybe 15 yards total. And then AJ Brown's going to have like a buck 20 for two touchdowns.
Jess, here's, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to do this. Are you ready? Super Bowl MVP plus 1600 to score two touchdowns plus 850.
Yeah, that's
all
day.
I'm taking both of those.
That's
I'm
all
not
day.
Even fucking around. Yeah. I'm taking both of those.
That's money.
You're gonna when I'm not doing a show next week and it's because I'm fucking in Hawaii because AJ Brown hit every one of these overs and I'm gonna be fucking kicking back in a kayak eating a fucking fresh lobster. All right, Jess, we went super long. Fucking hit the button.
All right, guys and gals, thanks for listening. Like always, Super Bowl is out of the way. We're just waiting for this weekend's game to play out and see how it goes. Thanks to everybody listening. Thanks for waiting that week. You know, we got to have a break too. Thanks to Jay for, you know, always being there, doing the show. Love having you be my co-pilot on this adventure. And thank you to Variety Sports Network for picking us up and helping support us in the podcast.
Shout out Variety Sports.
To go along with that, I will say if you have Twitter, please follow us. We don't have any other form of media, social media stuff going on. So follow us on Twitter, Jason at Valdez spelled backwards, 559. Myself at JTT81. The pod at Team Toss 21 and our sponsor co-supporters at Variety Sports Network at Variety_Sports_. That's it for us. Enjoy this weekend's event and all the things that come with it.
Peace, guys.